Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and it's been broadcast on community radios in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, an interview about Europe's first Muslim mayor, Sadiq Khan. And who better to ask about it than Alex Pascal, Britain's first black broadcaster from Radio London. This is the first of two interviews with him. Then Rita and Eddie join us from the Palestine Museum here in the centre of Bristol to talk about the Nabka, which is the commemoration, can't call it the celebration, the commemoration of the struggle of the Palestinian people against the invading and occupying Israeli government. Then Chris Hewitt, he's a railway expert from one of the best in the country, actually, and he's down in Salford on Saturday the 21st of May, and we'll be talking to him about the Somerset and Dorset line. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk.
Hi, Tony. I'm Alex Pascal, former producer-presenter of BBC Radio London's Black Londoners. From 1974 till 1988, and I work in the field of media communication. I see myself more as a communicator.
Now, Alex, you're being very modest there, because actually you were pretty much the first, weren't you? Black program on the BBC.
Tony, yeah, you know, in 1974, as we led into that period, leading from the 60s in, there was very little, if any, presence whatsoever on British radio or television. And the circumstances were so dire with the police and what they were doing to the black community and so, that a number of people, black and white, approached the BBC.
But it's fair to say, isn't it, that there was really systematic racism. I know in Brixton it was pretty obvious to most people that the police were systematically racist.
There was no doubt about that. Suspected and arrested, just loitering, they put it down and they picked you up. It was blatant. They were taking up young people, beating them. Some young people even died and were stuffed up into chimneys and so. And if a girl had a short haircut, they would take her, throw in the meat van, as we used to call it, and say, it was proved to us that you're a girl. I mean, I had my own turns. We're dressed in the night, you go to do show business work, and you're coming home and you would just be stopped, pitched on the wall, abused. And racism was really rampant at that period.
So you turning up on the radio, it must have been quite a shock, I suppose.
It was in many ways, because I remember some of the guys at Radio London, particularly there was one creature in the newsroom who once said to me that the people wouldn't understand me. And I was laughing. I said, so you mean black Londoners appearing on BBC Radio London has a different set of people who listen to it than the white people who listen to it. So we had a few senior people too in the BIB who were stirring or keeping this old norm with the hope that there would not be black intrusion or minority presence within, be it radio or on television. But with time, you had to stand your ground. There were beautiful people inside that too, because I remember when I was having a real toss and turn over demanding that we should have more black presence, people to work with me. I got one little card from a guy who was producing Radio 4. His name I can't remember right now. And he said to me, Alex, please don't believe that we are all the same. That said quite a lot to me. But the management of the BIB, the director general, Aubrey Singer, and so he was rude. I mean, beyond rude. He's somebody who came down to me at Radio London through the people I had out from in my room. And the language that went on after then left me to believe that there is no respect in the upper tier, so why bother? But I never fell out with the people, black and white, who worked with me, rallied with me, and we had to build something from scratch. lots of ideas which are moving today came from there. Lots of the black young people going into the profession, in some ways they were told again by a specific person there, don't ever mention black Londoners when you go to anything, because you're talking about ghetto programming.
Did you find it actually on the air live sometimes that you would be breaking news, I suppose, and for the first time people were hearing black people in London actually bearing their souls about some of the racism that was rife in the city?
Tony, let me put it like that. I think I was the precursor to the internet. Let me explain that. Because if I went to Africa, but in particular the Caribbean, where it happened to me as I was driving in a taxi, a guy is looking at me and he's saying to me, you sound just like a fellow who we listen to from London. And I said to him, what do you mean? He said, yes, man. There's a program in Britain called Black Londoners in London. Where are you from? He said. I said, London. He said, you never heard about the guy? I said, no. He says to me, well, hold on. By the way, I have a tape here, cassette. And he put it on and we're driving up Churchill Roosevelt Highway in Trinidad. And he said, listen to this guy, man. That's you, man. That's you. And I said to him, no, but when I go back to London, I would listen to him. You see what I'm saying? And those were the days when you were not supposed to do cassetting. But this is how something spread right around the world. So I'd be getting mails and so from Africa, from the United States, from all different parts of the world. And people coming through London then just came straight to me. Or when they went to the BBC as black people, or asked for the BBC with a cab, the cabman would just drive them straight to BBC Radio London on Marylebone High Street. So it was quite interesting.
Now, what about bringing this up a bit more up to date? We're in a situation now. We've just had actually what many people see as a racist campaign in the run-up to the mayor elections, and yet London has, it seems, turned its back on those particular messages and decided to elect a Muslim as Europe's first Muslim mayor of London.
Well, I find the term Muslim even we need to question. Nobody would say they elected a Jewish that, or they elected a white that, or so. And this is a person who's grown up here. So if we begin to keep that form of terminology for people who are actually British, born or bred in Britain, then we ourselves would be helping to sustain this form of racism.
Okay, I mean, I suppose I should backpedal a bit there, but Alex, I mean, the point being that it was really an anti-Islamist campaign run by Zach Goldsmith, wasn't it? So that's, you know, that's why I think it matters.
It was debasing for a person like Goldsmith to do that. It was even worse for a prime minister who himself, if you remember, wore a little button that Mandela should be hung. We must never forget that. Cameron did that. And a person like Boris to behave like Trump of America. I have spent nearly six decades in the United Kingdom. I've never seen it so disunited. And I have never seen political leadership in a more lesser form than we are seeing it at this moment.
Hang on, I mean, so why do you say that? What do you mean? The leadership is deficient? Why? How?
Well, leadership without any form of credibility, and let me put it like that. A prime minister making and saying things that he says, and being in league with people like Boris and others, I don't care what he brings forward, it can't work. Thank goodness many of us don't want to leave Europe and seize this partnership relationship, because just that little bit of water between here and France makes no difference. If France coughs, we'll catch a cold. There is no run away from that. I was pleased when Obama said to him, well, think again, because yes, we have this relationship with you, Britain, but we have to trade with Europe. And looking at the news today and what it is saying about if Britain left I don't think we should be talking about leaving. I'm pleased with what the outcome has brought. It shows that the people understand where we are and that from a one-to-one, people-to-people in London that has all these minorities, we have shown that things can change and that the mentality of London's community is more taking a shape of responsibility for what London is rather than what the Prime Minister or Boris or Goldsmith would want to tell them.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? It's almost like there's been a kind of ignoring of the leaders and London has decided, well, we're not going to listen to them. We're going to do our own thing.
And that's the way it should be. What Livingstone said, politicians are like, how do I put it?
Let's be clear about what he did say. He was doing something rather incendiary, which is linking Hitler with the Zionist project, that is the creation of the State of Israel. But although lots of papers reported it as him saying Hitler was a Zionist, that's not actually what he said.
No.
What he actually said was Hitler supported Zionists in 1933, which,
that's true.
Historically, if you look at the Havara Agreement that was made between the Zionists and Hitler in 33 is true, you know, so difficult to he seems to me a little bit like a provocative thing to say at the time.
It was not necessary, but Livingstone, that's the way he is. And
some politicians are actually great provocateurs. They'll say the thing that maybe is being talked about down the pub, which is not being talked about on Newsnight.
Politicians and certain areas of the press wants to avoid things when they want to and play up the other when it is the way they want things to go. And I think this is a message to us as journalists not to take part in this, but to remain the objective form of people that the people, the nation, can trust to keep the politician right.
But hang on, Alex, because isn't it a bit of a myth that journalists are balanced, are unbiased? I mean, there was a very good article by Owen Jones in The Independent about a year or so ago pointing out that a lot of senior political analysts at the BBC were former Conservatives or, you know, heads of the Young Conservatives and this sort of thing. And this whole idea of journalists being balanced, isn't it a bit of an illusion?
Well, I'm glad that you put it this way. Objectively, we should be objective, but it is impossible to be totally, and I'll give you a good example. Could you imagine what it was like for me, running Black Londoners, to be totally objective? I couldn't follow the norms of what the BBC set down, and I was never part of the BBC. But here I am, given a program to run with no money, no support, and yet be supposed to keep up the norms and be part of what the status quo wants. It couldn't happen. You could not expect a little program like this to address for redress, to put the situation that was wrong racially here in Britain. That was impossible. But I was able to steer it, and with the help of people and understanding of what we needed, we managed through a number of years, 14 years, until superior management and super management decided, with Thatcher and the police somewhat, because it was that Thatcher era of almost making everything the way she wanted. And things went haywire. From then on, we have had no presence. And there's one more thing. The government here, or governments, are playing games between the Asian community and the Black community, the ones who have the money and those who they think will give problems. We cannot build a nation like that.
That was Alex Pascal, Britain's first Black broadcaster on Radio London, as it was then back in the 1970s and 1980s. And we'll be more from him next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now, Chris Hewitt, he's a railway expert. He's actually from Coventry, around that area, that part of the country. But he's down here in Salford on Saturday the 21st of May at 2 o'clock at the Community Hall to talk about the Somerset and Dorset line. Chris Hewitt has got a lot to say, in fact, not just about the Somerset and Dorset, also about HS2. And I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago.
My name's Chris Hewitt. I'm a business and IT journalist by profession, and I go around the country giving talks on railways. That's both from before the First World War right up to the present day.
What's your interest? What piqued your interest in railways?
I was always encouraged to associate with railmen because they were honest, hard-working people, and these are people you should look up to, and they often did quite unpleasant jobs for not very much money. I think the biggest one, of course, was the, like most boys, I wanted to be an engine driver, which is a highly skilled job.
What is your talk about? I mean, what is it to do with railway history that you're able to tease out?
It's actually about Irish railways, looking at the Irish main line. Ireland is, if you look at what happens in Ireland, it's much easier to understand what happens in Britain, because being a much, you know, far fewer people and levels of bureaucracy to go through. One thing that's good about Ireland is they don't waste anything like the amount of money that Britain has done, because they haven't got anything to waste. You know, you can actually find photos of the latest diesels hauling quite elderly stock. You know, as long as it gets you from A to B and it's comfortable and clean, people aren't all that bothered. There are a lot of Irish people in the Bristol-Gloucester area. Well, the joke always is, of course, that the Irish learnt their rugby from Gloucester. That's why they have a very physical approach to the game. I've got scars to prove it. And there is an enormous amount of interest in railways in the Bristol area. Even today, the Bristol Committee of the Great Western, they spent more money on the line. That's why you've got nicer stations and Sydney Gardens and all the rest of it. And like the London one, you're a bit on skinflint. That's why the viaduct over the River Severn at Maidenhead is made out of brick, not Cotswold stone. Sydney Gardens is gardens through Bath. And the walling, the cutting and the walling is done in the same, made out of the same limestone as Bath is done. It's got the same Georgian styling.
Railways had their heyday, really, probably the late 1800s, early 1900s. But since the 60s, it's all become about cars.
Yes and no, but the reality is that there is too much business for the road lobby to handle. The only reason you've got so many vehicles on the roads is because the commercial operators effectively get a free road. They don't pay anything like the amount of road fund tax they should do. And by the way, I do actually believe that road fund tax should be ring-fenced. That would actually reduce rates and business tax, business rates and council tax.
It would, but I mean, it seems since we haven't got the little tax disc on the cars anymore in Britain, that there seems to be more potholes appearing. Is that just coincidence?
The potholes are down to Nigel Lawson's last budget. He robbed the road maintenance budget for something like 10 years. And the motoring organisation said at the time it won't be till about 2020 that all the potholes are filled in.
Fascinating. But anyway, what do you make of the beaching cuts? Because one of the nice things that came out of it is we've got all these preserved railways.
Absolutely right. Yes, it is nice to be able to branch lines again and see, you know, something looking like you know, the Nera, when you didn't have to lock your back door and the coppers gave you thick ears, and yeah, in my case, more often than I care to admit. And but I think beaching was put there to destroy the railway network for the benefit of the roads lobby. By the way, that's the road builders, not the ordinary private motorist who still doesn't get a much better deal than they did in the steam era. When Ernest Marples were looking around for a chairman for BR,
hang on, he was the transport secretary, I think, underneath maybe was it Ted Heath, or was it before that?
During the Macmillan government, Ernest Marples was the transport minister. He was his wife held the shares in Marples Ridgeway, who built the first motorways. But something you wouldn't get away with today, by the way. Well, the way they're looking around for a chairman just to make BR profitable, Their first choice was Courtauld's boss, Sir Frank Caton. Sir Frank said he would only accept the job if he was allowed to bring his own team of accountants in. Now, most of a good chunk of his accountants were trained by the same man who took my accounting course at Coventry Technical College. So, therefore, I know precisely the reason he wanted to do that, because he wanted an accurate set of books doing. The Steam Era Railway did not actually lose money. What cost the money was going out, was spending the modernisation plan on buying loads and loads of diesels that have never ever worked properly. Because then you've got whopping great write-offs and scrapping perfectly good steam engines. Steam should have lasted at least another 40 years. If you look at what David Wardale did on South African railways, he took a standard South African Pacific and doubled the horsepower using some things that anyone who's done school physics would understand.
So why didn't that happen here?
Sir Humphrey is under the thumb of the road and oil lobbies. Sir Humphrey, the civil service only sees railways as a device to bring their secretaries and cleaners into work, and for the few people who haven't got driving licences. They, of course, have chef-driven limos for supposed security reasons.
But, I mean, we had one of the best, if not the best, railway network in the world. How did they get away, and what was the process by which they started to take it apart?
The media at the time was not critical enough. For example, today, no minister would get away with having family shares in the road building company without having to put them into a blind trust. David Cameron, please note and copy.
Now, I notice Ernis Marples, I think he ended up his days out in Monte Carlo or Monaco or somewhere like that, because the tax man was after him.
Yes, he was tipped off that the police were on the way to arrest him. And literally, this sort of he literally just threw some clothes into a case and he left about 5 minutes before they arrived.
And this is the man behind the initial stages of Britain's motorway building programme.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, Britain's motorway building programme was drawn up by a senior civil servant in 1937 who visited Nazi Germany, looked at all the autobahns, got out school atlas and drew what effectively is the current motorway network on there. I said, this is the network we need without costing it out. Had Dr. Beeching properly costed out the social costs of using road, rail, air and canals, there's no motorways would have been built, or very few motorways would have been built. You certainly would have a lot of investment in the canals. There's a lot of things that they could carry.
But hang on, Chris, because they're slow. You can't get stuff across the country on a canal.
You can if you put in sort of locks that the French have got, which where you place a flight of locks with one super lock. And also, lots of stuff doesn't need to go quick. There are lots of things that don't need to go quickly.
It's a question of time for the person who's actually maybe the driver, or if you take in the terms of a barge, someone who's actually the captain of the barge.
Yeah. If you were to ask the Waterways Board, they would give you a long list of freight that could easily go by canal, which is not very time dependent.
Well, that's interesting, because there's actually quite a lot of money being spent on restoring canals too.
Yes, that's right. That's down to Tom Rolt, who founded the Talithlin Railway Society. He was also a big canal enthusiast.
What about the group that put the Beeching cuts in place? I think the Stediford Advisory Committee were also behind the close down of the tram network after the Second World War, because they said that trams caused congestion. A bit cheeky.
Well, the Stediford Committee is a very secretive organisation. There's only one book being published, and that was by a former railman who actually just went through tons and tons of files to get the appropriate paperwork out. The Stediford Committee have a lot to do with destroying the rail network in Ireland, because they told the Irish Republic's government, unless you agree to pay these subsidies for Northern Ireland, we're just going to close down the whole lines.
So who was on this committee? When you say it's secretive, tell us, throw a bit of light on it.
Well, finding light on Stediford is very, very difficult. Sir Humphrey did a very good job. The best known member was, of course, Dr. Richard Beeching. I've always understood this is the reason that he was the second choice for the BR chairmanship, because he was he came from a working home. His father was a journalist in Kent, and he was guaranteed to do the dirty work because he'd been offered a big salary.
Now, he was from ICI, but actually he was he'd been involved in armaments during the war. And he was actually his expertise was in metallurgy. Why was that? I mean, the only connection I can think with the railways is the actual railway lines themselves.
The metallurgy side Cecil Allen, that's Ian, one of Ian Allen's family, that's who does all the book, a lot of railway books. Cecil Allen was the person responsible for lots of the buying of specification of metal on the railways, and he did a very good job, you know, just on the back of envelopes. No, Dr. Beeching was Deputy Director of Weapons Research for the Army during World War II. His only claim to fame there was he invented the Armalite round as an academic exercise.
Might people find your talk interesting in Bristol?
Because Ireland is a relatively small population, and it's much easier to trace why things happen. The Irish Republic does tend to follow what happens in London, in the British Parliament. And when you see things being done, it's, if you look at what's happening in Ireland, you can actually see see how it should have been done. Like, although the Irish rushed out and bought the same sort of rubbishy diesels that British Railways did, but unlike BR, the Irish Railways very quickly just realised they were rubbish and sidelined them. The ones that were not quite up to standard, they put in General Motors engines. They did this about 30 years ago. I mean, it's only in the last 10 years that Class 47s have had decent General Motors engines in, which makes them vastly more reliable and gives them the same acceleration as electric trains.
So you think that actually the British maybe have some lessons to learn from the way the Irish have managed their rail?
Certainly, particularly the refusal to throw away perfectly serviceable stock. We hear every day that about commuters being packed in like cattle. Well, actually, the RSPCA would prosecute any rail operator who packed in cattle that tightly. But the stock is there. There are hundreds, if you get the trade press for the railway industry, there are hundreds of carriages up for sale almost every month. There's no shortage of carriages or locomotives. All right, even if they're only used once a day. For years, for about over 50 years, the Dutch have been using older stock just to run rush hour extra services. And it works very well because everyone knows that, all right, if you get the train, the heritage stock, everyone knows that's only going to be used for two journeys a day. So people don't mind it. And in fact, a lot of people actually prefer to catch the heritage trains because the things like the seatings are, you know, more comfortable and, you know, the nicer designs. The other thing the Irish get right, when they close a line, they're not allowed to take up the track or signalling for 10 years. So that means it's very easy to reopen if there's a change of government or the people or a local authority decides to subsidise it. It's much, much easier to get lines reopened. I mean, whether the government likes it or not, there are lots of the damage done by Beeching is going to have to be undone. For example, the Somerset and Dorset should never have been shut. That would significantly improve the amount of trains that could travel between the Midlands and the North and the Bournemouth area. Somerset Dorset started at Bath's Green Park, then went up to Midsummer Norton, Radstock, Midsummer Norton, then down to Temple Coombe. Eventually it would go through the Dorsetshire countryside, Broadstone Junction, bringing you into Bournemouth West. The main object was that on summer Saturdays you had packed, and I mean packed, holiday trains from the Midlands and the North. They would all be going southbound in the morning, and in the afternoon they'd all be going northbound. There'd be the same trains would be returning. But I've got loads and loads of slides on. There's more books being published about the Somerset and Dorset than almost any other branch line. I've got dozens and dozens of them. And you look at all these summer Saturday trains, they're packed. Now, the railways, if you like the steam age, the railways didn't run holiday extra trains as an act of charity. They ran it because they got paying customers to fiddle them with. The current operators, ever since sectorisation, the railway policy is to use fares, ludicrously high fares, to price people off the network. I mean, I come from Coventry. I believe if I travel down to London on Virgin, I believe it's the highest cost per mile in Europe.
Frightening, isn't it? Well, Midsummer Norton and Radstock have got a bit of steam preservation, preservation yeah. active. Midsummer Norton's got its own little line, and there's talk about something similar happening in Radstock too.
Oh, it's all very good, but there's no reason why the government could not get the line completely reopened. There is a place for preserved steam engines on these lines because, you would run, say, preserved engines, say, every hour, and that would be for people who just want to ride behind a steam engine. And because you've got a decent length of line, modern signalling, you'd probably considerably accelerate the services.
Preserve railways around the country. Yeah. What you're suggesting, maybe, is that those could be more joined up to the network, and that maybe Network Rail could be running trains on those lines too.
Network Rail should actively look at joining lines up and giving the paths to run through services. I mean, for example, there's no reason why Centro could not run services from Bridgnorth and the Severn Valley into Birmingham.
Do you think this will ever happen? Because I think a lot of people look at these old lines and think, I wonder if there'll ever be trains running on there again in the future. We keep hearing, don't we, about the possibility of oil crises. We all know that there's far too many cars on the road.
Yeah. Well, it's not too many cars. It's too many lorries and buses that aren't paying the full whack. If all lorries coming off the ferries at places like Dover had to pay by a road fund tax for a week, you'd very quickly get the money in to actually get rid of all the potholes.
So we're secretly subsidising those big lorries we see?
Yes, we are. Both the rail users and the private motorists are subsidising them because they pay no UK tax and they usually avoid paying UK fuel duty by filling up in Britain so that we don't get the benefit of the tax on the fuel either.
Very frustrating. Anyway, Chris, I just wondered if you could recommend a couple of books on the history of railways that you think that maybe, if people can't make your talk, that you could recommend, because it's a big subject and you're a bit of an expert.
Well, my favourite one is, of course, The Official History of the Great Western Railway, which is four volumes. The first three were written by the Great Western Railway, and the fourth one was written by rail legend O.S. Knock. That they are, you know, they're worth reading cover to cover. The other interesting one is The Official History of the Southern Railway, which is difficult to get hold of because during the Blitz, a bomb struck the bookstore and they were nearly all burned. I mean, I'm lucky to have had a copy. But there's a lot of interesting stuff in, particularly about the Somerset and Dorset in the Bristol and Bath areas. If you wanted something with the... A lot of the early Ian Allen books have got... particularly the annuals are very good. It's a pleasure to read books that... they've got no spelling mistakes, no swear words, pictures properly captioned and, properly bound. But Ian Allen used to publish a Trains Illustrated from 1948 till I think about 1970. Those books are also worth having, even though you might think they're a bit old. They've got an enormous amount of information that you can't get today.
Now, Britain were the inventors of the railway, and yet it seems that we were also the first country to get rid of our railways. Do you think that there'll be some sort of thing in the future where it's all revived?
I think everyone's realising that. Unfortunately, they're making the mistake of thinking that HS2 is the answer. The growth in rail traffic is between London and the North West. I could deliver you the extra capacity by simply reopening the Midland Main Line from Sheffield into Manchester and upgrading that to 125 mile an hour. Also, that line goes up to Leeds and Settle and Carlisle and Glasgow. That, again, would be very easy to upgrade to 125 mile an hour. The actual difference in time saving between 120 and 250 in most journeys is only 5-10 minutes. Certainly, I'm also reopening the Great Central. The Great Central was designed for high-speed travel. That one is even easier to convert to 125 mile an hour, plus the fact it does link London with the East Midlands and the North West in one fell swoop. But people are starting to realise it. I think the problem with rail, because HS2 keeps on quoting stupid prices, it doesn't cost 50 billion. I mean, you know, I'll do it for 30 billion and I'll still have 5 billion left over in my back pocket. And that would include using as much existing track as possible, which they're supposed to do in the government policy. I think the other problem is that I think that highways and railways are now under the same department. And because the amount of money being quoted for HS2, and I might say this Trans-Pennine link as well, is so ludicrous, it's making motorways look more cost-effective, which they're not.
Do you think it will ever happen, HS2?
I could put a team together to build HS2 for you tomorrow. It would take you 2.5 years. The trouble is you wouldn't be able to run more than 180 miles an hour. The national grid doesn't generate enough power to run trains at more than 180. Don't forget, you're talking about a very intense service. You're talking probably a service every 10 minutes. Also, if it was open now, you'd have to be charged, from Birmingham to London, you'd have to charge £300 second class and £500 first class. And sorry, you'd be hard pushed for any businessman to want to pay that on the company expenses. It's just not realistic. And the other thing that I find most interesting about HS2, if you read the original HS2 documents, which I've got able to download off the web before they miraculously disappeared, they assume that HS2 is going to take over all Virgin's business. Now, I haven't heard Richard Branson saying anything, and Richard is a very, very sharp operator. he's keeping a very sophisticated silence about this, because I think he privately knows it's going to fall on its face, and he will be and he'll be able to turn around and say, well, if you give me the money, I could have put more trains on the West Coast Main Line. Also one of the original things is that if you live in Coventry, to use HS2, you would have to go to Birmingham International. You then have to go to the new station, which is on the other side of Birmingham International, which is nearly a mile. Then that gets you to London 15 minutes faster. You're not even saving 5 minutes. Now, what happens if when you get out at Euston, you can't get a taxi or a bus or the tubes or the problems with the tube? You spend all this extra money for nothing. Yet upgrading the Midland Main Line, reopening the Great Central would actually give you all that extra capacity with almost no disruption to existing services.
What do you put down all this silly bureaucracy and bad decision-making to?
A lot of it is down to the management consultancies, who are the curse of all Western business today. They're like drug pushers. They're only interested in getting you hooked rather than solving your business problems. And what it means is that you give them some money, and the advice is designed in such a way that you have to keep on giving more money and more money and more money for more and more advice. Right? If you actually remove the management consultancy stage out of HS2, you're saving something between 5 and 10 billion. It's that sort of levels. And you get the same problems, if you go around banks or any other big companies, they're in hocks to these consultancies, and nobody's got the guts to say, to pull the life support. Because, I mean, these people, they're just parasites. There is a place for management consultancy, but not when they take over and run your business for you without permission. Most of HS2 involves reusing the Great Central Railway. Now, the Great Central was designed for high-speed travel. It requires a very little extra effort to actually... All you're talking about is redesigning junctions and avoiding one or two places, so you've got 124-mile-an-hour curves instead of 100-mile-an-hour curves. Most of it is relatively simple and could actually be done by a small team of half a dozen people, not teams of 200, 300, 400, 500. It's like if you saw when the Virgin paid for the West Coast to be upgraded. There was this village in the middle of nowhere, halfway between Euston and Coventry. This village of porter cabins turned up. So, like 200 or 300 people there, and all they were doing was redrawing drawings that were perfectly good, rewriting things that didn't need rewriting. And this site has completely disappeared now. But if you get all of the paperwork and you actually say that we as taxpayers paid good money for all this, we could have got 6 formers to do it.
Is that down to the management consultants again?
It's largely down to the management consultants, because one thing management consultants are very, very good at is persuading civil servants it's in their interests to give them large cheques. I know this would make a good episode for Yes Minister. All major companies are paying vast amounts of money to management consultants for very little business benefit.
Okay, so if you were Secretary of State for Transport, Chris, yeah. I imagine they'd be the first to go.
There would be a very, very thorough review. I would expect to cut the management consultancy bill by at least 3/4, because most of the skills you've got in-house anyway.
Railway writer and expert Chris Hewitt there, who's coming down to Salford. It's just in between Bristol and Keynsham, Bristol and Bath. Direction on the A4, just off the A4. It's signposted, actually, as you go through Salford on the left-hand side. The Community Hall, Saturday the 21st of May at 2 p.m. is where you can have a chat. And if you've got any questions for Chris, do go along.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Right, well, I'm pleased to introduce Eddie and Rita, Eddie Clark, from the Palestine Museum. A big week for you. Why is that?
This week is the Nakba commemoration, which is... Nakba means catastrophe in Arabic, and is when Israel state established, and is a big celebration for the Israeli, but is...
Why this week, though? Is what's the actual events, historically, that...
It's just to commemorate the catastrophe, which the Palestinians been pushed out. More than 500 villages, they been evacuated, and making more than 750,000 refugees. They've been kicked out.
That's a lot of people, isn't it?
It's a lot of people, yeah.
And also, of course, you're creating another load of refugees. At some point, they're going to want to say, well, we want our homeland back, just like the Jews who were migrating
at the end of the Second World War and after the Second World War, they said the same thing. So you've got two ethnic, different ethnic groups competing for the same bit of land.
Exactly. The biggest refugees in the world is actually the Palestinian. They are between 6 million, 7 million. I'm not exactly know the number, but it's between 6 million, 7 million people just living in diaspora around the world in the refugee camps and just being emigrated all over the world.
We've just been through, Eddie, a big scandal to do with anti-Semitism in the run-up to the local elections. What's your view of that? I imagine that you maybe support Ken Livingstone and some of the things that he said about linking the Zionists in the 1930s to the Nazis.
Yes, I mean, to actually conflate, you know, being critical of Israel with anti-Semitism is got to be the worst biggest prank. And secondly, being anti-Zionist, being anti-Israel, is definitely not anti-Semitic. So they tried to pull this off, and I think what it's done is kind of misfired on them, because in effect, they actually cry wolf, and they actually reduce the effectiveness of fighting true anti-Semitism.
But what about accusations? The Prime Minister made some accusations, didn't he? Some quite serious ones about Sadiq Khan, who's now London Mayor. Just the week before the mayor election, saying that he shared a platform with one of the masterminds of 7/7.
Well, I mean, Cameron, let's face it, is he really a sensible prime minister? Is he really talking common sense? Because I don't believe he is. I think it's just electioneering at its very grimmest.
Well, and I would say probably London also agrees with you, because they roundly voted for the first Muslim mayor in Europe. What does this mean for you at the Palestine Museum, Rita? Does it actually affected you, having the first Muslim mayor of Europe in Britain somewhere?
Doesn't make any difference.
No?
Well, I think...
I mean, we'll see.
Go on, Eddie.
What I would say is, in a way, he kind of he matches us, because we were the first Palestinian museum probably in the world. So he's the first, you know, MP, or not MP, actually, you know, he's a mayor, mayor of London.
And he'll be meeting with all the other mayors from all over the rest of Europe. And it's interesting that London sent a very important sign, I think, to the world there. Maybe it's only the London media, the BBC, Sky, the national newspapers that believe what Cameron was saying and Zach Goldsmith was saying. I don't know if anyone else does, do they?
No. I just thought
we should have a Muslim prime minister one day.
Yeah.
Well, maybe not? Sadiq Khan might be the man, won't he? The next general election, who knows?
Yeah. Some cynics are saying that he is a stalking horse.
Anyway, certainly seems like the plates are shifting in a way nationally in your favour towards the sort of campaigning and awareness raising you're doing. Eddie, what do people see when they come to the Palestine Museum in Bristol?
Well, what they see is the rich history of Palestine, you know, going back, you know, before record books, you know, it's woven into its tapestry, into its art, into its folklore, actually into its dress design. It predates Christianity, and it was a wonderful, cohesive place. I mean, I do remember when it was first mooted that they would have a creation of Israel, and they sent a few rabbis over there to look at the place, and they came back and said, the bride is beautiful, referring to Palestine, but it's already taken. They went back 6 months later and changed their tune. So, you know, what people will see is also the sad destruction of the culture.
Okay, where are you and when are you open?
We're open 11 till 6, both days of the weekend. We're at 27 Broad Street.
So just Saturdays and Sundays, is it?
At the moment, but we do intend to open, you know, longer hours when we open
the
cafe.
Well, I hate to say it, but I'm sure there's people who, after work, working in the city centre, would quite like to have a little mooch around after work. So any chance of one week during the evening during the week?
Open? Well,
Rita?
I think if people want to come and visit the museum any time or the week, or if there is a group of people want to come, we are ready to open.
How do people contact you then?
Via email, through the website.
Have you got a phone number?
No, we don't have a phone number, but we have a Twitter and we have a Facebook.
Okay, so it's email. What's your email address?
It's palestinian.museum.center@outlook.com.
Outlook.com. What kind of events are you planning? Friday the 27th, something's happening. And also, I'm thinking, how long does the Nakba
commemoration go on for?
It really just goes on for 1 week as a commemoration, but the Nakba process is still continuing as long as Israel's destroying, you know, the property and stealing the land. So it's an ongoing thing, but and we do record that inside the museum.
Because this is one of those things, I think it's really important to get your head around the history, because Britain had played a very big part, didn't it, in Palestine. Britain was occupying it at the end of the Second World War. I've spoken to soldiers, I'm sure you have too, elderly men who were over there at the time, maybe stationed in the King David Hotel, and saw the Jewish terrorism that led to the creation of the State of Israel. Also, with the United States charging in straight away to recognise the new state, which was created through terrorism. And actually, maybe many states around the world have been created by terrorists, and then suddenly they're recognised. But that's exactly what happened in Israel. But the history is so important. To me, if you don't understand the history, you've got no idea what's going on today. And I remember the words of Hitler's deputy, Martin Bormann. He said, educated men, actually maybe he said educated people, I'm not sure, are our future enemies. So that's what you're doing. You're educating us.
That's right. But far removed from, you know, the Nazi system, though, thank goodness.
Well, that's right. I mean, he's saying that a lot of what the Nazis were planning after the war and during the war was based on ignorance. Mm-hmm. They wanted people to be reacting, ignorant people to just react to their orders effectively, behaving. I'm thinking about George Orwell now, or Animal Farm, you know, like farms of people. Right, we're going to tell them to do this, they're going to do it. They're not even going to think about it. Yeah. And education is the one way that people will go, hang on a minute, we're not doing that.
Well, I don't think it's just education, it's critical thinking as well. There's one thing to be educated, there's another thing to challenge what you're being educated.
Hang on a minute, because you can be educated to think critically. You can be, as part of your education, I don't think that is really what's been going on in primary schools the last few weeks with these tests for 6 and 7 year olds.
Another story, isn't it?
I know, but isn't it mad?
Yeah, it
is. So I feel like, does Britain want people to be educated or no? I think maybe they don't want to. So when they're 16, they just leave the school and join the army.
Well, we had a pretty good system of education after World War II in the socialist government with the secondary modern schools, grammar schools. A lot of people didn't agree with the splitting people up, but it did produce some pretty well-educated. I mean, I was a lot last year grammar school boy. So the year after me at my school in Beckenham in Kent, it was Langley Park. It was a comprehensive school. You actually couldn't tell much of the difference because the teachers were pretty much the same. But I'm a bit concerned. At the moment, the biggest vote that's happened in Britain for about 40 years is going on, which is the Brexit vote. Now, Rita, you hadn't heard about what Brexit was. Yes. So it's not come across your...
To stay in Europe or to leave Europe?
Well, it's the EU. I mean, there's a lot of people say Europe, but it's not really Europe, is it? It's the EU, which is Brussels, really.
It's United Europe country.
United States of Europe?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, what are your thoughts about that? What's the view at the Palestine? Does the Palestine Museum have a view, the curators?
Yeah, well, I think the EU is probably the greatest, you know, achievement that Europe did. And I think a lot of Europeans are proud of it. I don't know why we got this kind of, you know, mentality we have. Maybe it comes back to education. Maybe if you keep people dumb, then they're easy to kind of like shepherd, like a sheep, you know what I mean? For one reason only, I'd say forget the monetary side. Because union is not only just about money, it's about morals, it's about other factors. But if you think about it, we've had no wars, and we're unlikely to ever have war amongst ourselves as we did in World War II. So
hang on. What about Yugoslavia?
Well, it wasn't in Europe.
Is Yugoslavia. It's in Europe.
In the European Union.
Well, it wasn't in the European Union, no. So, but I mean... Well,
if it was in European Union, maybe there was no war. Well,
they should have joined the European Union.
Exactly.
You're talking.
Look, there's a big problem with the EU, which lots of people have pointed out to me again and again, and that is that we can't actually get rid of the people running it. At least we can do that in Westminster.
Can we?
Yes. Yeah, we have things called votes, and every now and again, like we just had the Mayor of London vote, you know, people disappear and someone new comes along. Yeah, so you think they're all the same?
But do you really think we have power? The ministries run the country, not the parliamentary side of it.
So the permanent government.
The permanent government. You know what I mean? We know that. We know that that's, you know.
Anyway, Rita, what are your thoughts on Brexit?
Well, I think it would be, if we stay, we're just going to improve. When I came here many years ago, I came from Italy and we had a lira, okay? So, and I see this country was very expensive. The fruit and vegetable were, you know, just over the top as a price. And the price is actually the same now, almost 20 years later. So I think improve an economy, or my little economy.
But, I mean, anyway. The Greeks would disagree. Actually, the Italians would probably disagree, and the Spanish would disagree, wouldn't they?
They will, yeah. They like to be independent.
It needs restructuring. They should never have got to yoked.
Yeah, but Cameron's tried this, hasn't he? He tried it back a few months ago, and he came back with nothing.
Well, why? Because he was looking from a very selfish perspective. It wasn't what I call a real effort to kind of like meet the kind of requirements of the European Union. What it was Cameron trying to prove that he could push the EU around, and it didn't work.
Anyway, I've been a bit naughty, because I'm steering you away from what you come to talk about. Anyway, carry on, Rita.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, before everybody would say we should leave Europe, you should leave Europe. Now they're very...
The Swiss are not in the EU. Yeah, the Norwegians are not in the EU. Luxembourg,
I'm sorry.
Actually, yeah. Luxembourg is, isn't it? The Icelandics, they're doing quite well. They're not in the EU.
No, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
But anyway...
Well, it's just confusing because before it looked like, you know, we should leave EU, and now all the main parties say we should stay in EU, stay in EU. So it's looking like...
I'll tell you what my view, if everybody is okay,
we stay, why we have to vote?
Well, I'll tell you what my view is it'd be lovely for all the European countries to get on together and organise themselves well to actually have common policies, good, decent policies right across the... But Brussels is not it. Maybe at some point in the future, something else will come along to bring European countries together.
Okay.
I mean, that's just my take on it. Anyway, look, let's not get away from the NAGPA. NAGPA. Because you've got something going on Friday the 27th, haven't you, which is a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah.
The NAGPA is on Saturday.
Yeah, but you've got this event
with
Rafit Ziad. Coming at 7 o'clock.
Yes.
So who's Rafit Ziad?
Rafit Ziad is a Palestinian, and she's a performance, and she's quite famous for poet spoken words called "We Teach Life There." And if Eddie got much more information than me about Rafit.
Yeah, she was born in Lebanon from refugee parents. She's Palestinian. Both her parents are Palestinian. And she moved around the world. She was educated in Canada, I believe, and finally lives in London. And her particular, what do you call it, a poet come talk, was about Palestine. It was, and it reached, it did have such rave reviews that it actually went viral. Millions of people have heard this song. So she's coming to perform her particular piece of poetry, her statement on Palestine on the 27th. And, you know, we hope that's going to be a wonderful event. And we will try and broadcast it, link in through video conferencing, but early days yet.
Do you want to tell us what your website is then?
Yeah, it's Palm Museum, Bristol. .org.
Okay, so that's literally, it's Friday week, the 27th, Rafit Ziad, 7 p.m. I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll see if we can dig out some of her music and play it at the end of the show, just after the show's thing finishes.
Yeah. You'll love her.
And remind us where you are again.
27 Broad Street in Bristol, BS12HG.
Open Saturdays and Sundays, 11 till 6. So if you can, do pop in the Palestine Museum and Cultural Centre. Rita and Eddie, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
And thank you for inviting us.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast has been broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, Alex Pascal, also Rita and Eddie from the Palestine Museum, and Chris Hewitt, the railway expert. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. You can contact Rita and Eddie
through palmuseum.org, the website, palmuseum.org. And Chris Hewitt's talk is on Saturday the 21st of May, 2 p.m. at Saltford Community Hall. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute. Just contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. That was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
When I was born, I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious. When I was born suspicious. Suspected of a crime that I didn't commit yet. But I just say bet. Maybe it's my DNA, my genetical breakdown, because I'm skin brown. Homie is the clown that we all love to see on TV. But homie the clown ain't me, see? I kick the dick swift, cooler than Kool-Aid. And I can go off on the mic like a hand grenade. But still I chill because they expect me to have no respect for me, see? I ain't going out like a villain. I'm an anti-trigger happy nigga that's chillin'. Wake up, it's time for the brothers to wake up. See through the makeup. They don't know me, but they fear me. Because I might be vicious. And I was born suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
When I was born,
I was born suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
When I was born,
I was born suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
When I was born,
I was born suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
Today I'm getting to walk the streets at night without being harassed by the police. They say we all look alike. Well, that's a stereotype. Like P.E. said, don't believe the hype. Now they want to rough me up and lock me down. They got my face in the crown. Black man with a phone in custody. So now they want to take my fingerprints and ID.
It's not enough. They want to rough me up and scuff me up. 14 police just to cuff me up. I guess there's no caviar dreams and champagne wishes when you're born suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
When I was born,
I was born suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
When I was born,
I was born suspicious.
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 Right.
I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious.
Chili B, of course. I couldn't read my own writing. My apologies to him. That's Born Suspicious, the title track from a six-track CD from Alternative Tentacles.